Welcome, ladies and gentlemen, to another episode of Newborn Libertarian. And I'm with my co-host, as usual, Christian.
Hello.
And today we have a new guest on, and I will allow the guest to introduce himself. And if you could go ahead and introduce yourself.
Hi, I'm Chad Thayer. I'm a writer and blogger for jasonstapleton.com. I'm also a financial consultant. I work with startup businesses, helping them raise capital. I run a firm called Fifth Generation LLP out in here in sunny central Florida, and I'm very excited to be on the show today.
Right on. And like we do for every new guest that's on, if you can go ahead and give us a little bit of the history of where you came from politically, all the way from your history way back, if you're a libertarian, if you aren't a libertarian, or if you weren't one before and are one now, if you can go ahead and give us that background.
Sure. I was born into a family of Republicans, been Republicans going back nigh on 75, 85 years. My formal name is Charles Thayer V. That's with a Roman numeral 5. Nothing really changes in the Thayer family, not even the name. That's kind of where I started out. Going through high school, I was very much, I bought into the narrative, the invasion of Iraq. I was okay with George W. Bush because I didn't know a goddamn thing about what I was talking about. I went through college. I was not active politically. I've only ever voted once in my life. I voted for Barack Obama. I'm ashamed to say that now, but I'm also not because Sarah Palin. I was not particularly politically active in college. I've always known that I sat sort of I always knew that I sat, far right on fiscal positions and taxation, and on all the other stuff. My summary was, I do not give a shit. I don't care if you want to abort your baby. I don't care if you want to cover your body in tattoos. If you want to shoot heroin at a bus stop, go ahead. Just don't put it into my arm. That's always been my position. And so, later on in life, I kind of discovered libertarianism, discovered anarcho-capitalism, and discovered these ideas that that really just sounded like me. And I've continued to explore those. Now now I get the chance to do some exciting writing, and I really try to point out the absurdity of the system. I try to use satire as much as I can to help people see just how absolutely insane our system is when you don't question it.
Yeah, I think that's when you look at libertarians, I think a lot of libertarians kind of come from the right and kind of have the same feelings. I was the same way. I always knew I was fiscally, quote unquote, right leaning, but everything else, just didn't care about. Those are the seeds that are planted, and then when you finally find something that kind of, brings to light everything else you've ever believed, you realize there's a word for that, and that there are other people who believe what you believe. But we're glad to have you on, even though, a lot of people could kind of think they have the same journey as you kind of had. It's still a little different, and it's awesome hearing it. And every single time I hear that story, it reminds me of myself, and it reminds me just how, if we just get the messaging right, we can bring a lot of people to the liberty movement. But also, the reason that we had you, especially on the podcast today, was kind of to illuminate the differences in some schools of economic thought, kind of what are the merits and demerits, where they agree or disagree. And kind of take it from there, because there's libertarians [S2] Sure. [S1] Have a interest in economics. And someone put it a great way one time. You said, are you more Mises or are you more Friedman? Because for the uninitiated, you know, a lot of it sounds the same at first, but once you get into the weeds a little bit on economic theory, there are quite a few divergences, say, between the Chicago and the Austrian school. And I thought we could talk about that a little bit today and kind of, you know, come to an agreement, see where we agree, disagree, and kind of maybe even debate a little bit. What do you say?
I'm down for that. And just to add to that, one of the things I think that's missing from libertarianism in general is an even bigger perspective on the economic schools that exist outside of the Austrian school and the Chicago school. You know, there's a whole bunch of different schools that fall under the umbrella of what one would call either post-Keynesian or heterodox economic theories that, you know, there's a lot of really good work being done by academics in those schools, and those people, you know, to the mainstream economists, those people are just like we are to the mainstream political philosophers. They don't get published in the big journals. They don't get the big research grants. They're very much outsiders. And I think one of the things that makes the libertarian experience that much stronger and what makes us better is that we know our opponent's position inside and out. It's all we hear. It's this there's this default assumption that the status quo is the way that it should be. You know, our opponent is the home team. We are the away team. We have to outplay them, and we have to be better than them in order to win hearts and minds. And very much the same is very much true in economics. There's, you know, the mainstream neoclassical economics, which the Chicago school falls under mainstream neoclassical. Austrian economics falls outside of the neoclassical because of their position on things like numerical data, you know, quantitative studies, those kinds of things. So I think that there's a tremendous amount to be gained from exploring all of the outsider positions, because once you fully explore the, you know, the mainstream and the insider position, you see that it's crap. It's absolute crap. You know, and what you have to do with economics, and it's rare that you hear that you see you do this, but you have to go back to the source documents, and you have to read these PhD thesis papers written by Paul Samuelson, and you know, you have to read the work that the you have to read the foundation that the castle is built upon, because the foundation is full of holes, is full of cracks, is full of logical inconsistencies that they call assumptions, you know, and on it rests this whole you know, charade masquerading as a social science.
Yeah, I think that's a good segue into here, because when we talk about the Austrian school, and you know, you said it, we're kind of outside the school of thought of the mainstream. One of the things that an Austrian would say, you know, Mises did really well when developing human action. You know, the Austrian school goes all the way back to Karl Menger and the marginalist revolution there with the with subjective utility and whatnot. But one of the things that Mises has done did really well in Human Action was his, at the very beginning of the book, you know, it was really boring to read. I'm not going to lie. It was, yeah, from the very beginning, the very axiomatic things that, you know, you cannot disprove, basically that humans act using means to achieve some end, to satisfy some present state of uneasiness. You know, that can't be disputed. You know, it's why we're podcasting today, because we'd rather do that with our time than something else. And kind of the Austrian school from that, and you kind of hit on it, you know, we don't put as much faith in the, what would you call it, in numerical or quantitative?
I would call it the Miller High Life version of physics. It's economics trying to be physics.
Yeah.
It's economics trying to be calculus.
Yes.
It's trying to turn something where there are almost too many variables to actively be able to model them into models. That's,
right.
Yeah, so, you know.
You know, there are some things that, I mean, you can look at numbers for and you say, okay, well, this is the number. I mean, this is what happened in the past. The stats say this is a snapshot of history. But, you know, but Mises and the Austrian school kind of, it derives kind of, lost Chad for a second there. We're going to bring him back on here. All righty, and Kim's gone, so I can just sit and talk to myself. How you doing, buddy? Yeah, I'm doing all right. Just trying to get Chad back on, and I know Kim's not listening because she's still on the clock. Chad, you there?
Yes.
Okay.
Did we get just on, where did I lose you?
So I'm gonna start from the beginning of my sentence, and Kim can put it together because she's the technical person. Anyway. What I was going to say is the reason that Mises, you know, and you wouldn't put a whole lot of thought in trying to make economics some kind of physics or calculus is partially because of what you said and partially because, you know, you have to start with the true assumption at the foundation, and the true assumption only is that humans act. And from there, any kind of correct observation about the world around you has to be logically deduced from that. If it's illogically deduced or fallaciously deduced, the conclusion cannot be held in all circumstances, and you can't really uphold it as a rule of thumb. And where from an Austrian's perspective, for someone just to look at a bunch of statistics that happened in the past and, you know, run some regressions on it and kind of derive their conclusions from what happened in the past, which are, you know, variables that you can't reintroduce or can't resolve for, and you can't always isolate all of the variables. It's kind of, Austrians would say you're going down the wrong tunnel at that point.
The expression is ceteris paribus, and ceteris paribus is always, always impossible because you never run into a situation where all other things are being held equal. I mean, it's, you know, it's the minimum wage studies. Those, you know, the studies that the minimum wage doesn't cause unemployment. The number of confounding variables in there that are not stripped out because they don't want to strip them out fundamentally. And you know, the way they measure small changes, bringing it up by 50 cents an hour, that didn't cause a 6% rise in unemployment, therefore no rise in unemployment. Like, it kind of goes back to what you were saying, like, you know, if you have illogical things drawn, in your logical process, you know, in banking, the saying is garbage in, garbage out. And that's a lot of economics and a lot of anything where you're dealing with modeling, you know, because modeling is our best approximation of reality, but we often get it confused for thinking that the model is reality, and it's not.
Exactly.
You know, it's, you know, when you're modeling out the price on a mortgage derivative, you're going to model, you know, the big inputs that you think move the price. But, you know, the way that this thing moves in lockstep with other pieces of the mortgage market is almost never accurately described in your model, and therefore your model is crap and it means nothing. You know, that's during the financial crisis, you'd have guys at Morgan Stanley, calling up guys at Goldman saying, you owe us $2 billion. And they'd say, what are you talking about? They say, well, your MBSs are worth, they're worth 40, 45. And they'd say, no, the model says they're worth 85. And they'd say, your model is shit. Like, throw your model away and give us $2 billion. They're worth 45. Cents on the dollar, and you know, that's one of those sort of things that I think you see. It's bled over from economics into finance, because once you start to peel back the theories of corporate finance, you see that they're all based on, for the most part, on neoclassical economics. Things like the capital asset pricing model. you know, is based on the efficient markets hypothesis, which is based on, you know, based on a piece of neoclassical economics.
Yeah, so, I mean, even from an Austrian perspective, there are tools that, you know, say a neoclassical economist can use rather than working to try and forecast prices or do this or that based on their best guess. But, you know, an Austrian would say the job of the entrepreneur is to try to use the tools or means he can to predict these kind of things. And you can't really blame an entrepreneur because entrepreneurs don't have all the information at their fingertips. They have what they know. They have what they're experiencing and this and that. And if what they know is markets and regressions and analysis, you know, there's no reason not to use that tool and just see what happens. Now, when the model breaks down, of course, they've got to redo their model or something or see what they missed in the environment around them. But I think where neoclassical economics or post-Keynesian or post-classical economics differs from Austrian is really from its policy prescriptions as it pertains to government. Is where I see the huge discrepancy. And I mean, you can kind of look at it and you kind of hit on it with the minimum wage. You know, two economists from the same school of thought, think about it. One's very, you know, say Republican or right leaning or even libertarian leaning, and the other one's very left leaning, say like a Paul Krugman. They can use the same basis for why they chose certain variables. Pick different variables to use in their models and come up with two completely different reasons as to why the minimum wage does or doesn't have an effect on employment. And, you know, even Thomas Sowell, who's not an Austrian, you know, maybe he's Austrian sympathetic, has even come out and said, you know, when you look at the minimum wage, it's kind of like looking at a Russian roulette game after the fact and interviewing, you know, all of the survivors and saying, well, you know, these guys survived and they said it had no effect on them. So I guess Russian roulette is safe to play. Yeah. Whereas from an Austrian standpoint, it would kind of say, look, if you put a minimum wage, you're putting you're putting a price floor on, you're going to have a surplus of unused labor. And the Austrian can say that if you're not seeing that result, it's because you're not accounting for other things that have impacts the other way. Say, an astronomical increase in productivity anyway that kind of offsets that. Maybe you have inflation that creeps the minimum wage, you know, closer down in terms of its real cost, which would allow more people to get hired as time goes on. But, you know, when the left-leaning neoclassical studies or the left-leaning post-Keynesian studies, they're going to go and they're going to look at the businesses and they're going to choose these businesses for these particular reasons. They're going to choose the businesses that survive 5 years later. And they're going to say, what did the minimum wage have any effect on you? And they're not going to go interview the ones that got put out of business because they couldn't afford the price anymore. So from an Austrian,
well, no doubt there's a positive selection bias in there from Jump Street.
Yeah. And it really, it could come from the libertarian side of it too. That would be the problem that Austrians kind of have with it. Now the problem.
Yeah, I mean, can I start you off with one area in which both neoclassical economics and Austrian economics are both equally wrong?
Sure.
So that's the theory of the firm and the rising marginal cost assumption. So I'm sure you've seen the curves where it's a Nike swoosh on your marginal productivity per extra unit of capital. So the way that this assumption works is they assume that capital is fixed in the short run and that you're adding additional units of labor to that capital. So at first you get slightly more productive, then you get slightly more productive, and then you hit that point of diminishing returns and your marginal productivity per unit of labor then begins to fall, or, you know, both labor and capital, since your capital is fixed in this short run. And the analogy I've heard for this sort of assumption is you assume you've got a firm fixing a street, and you've got and you've got one guy, and he's using a jackhammer, and your number of jackhammers is fixed in the short run. That's your capital. So you hire an additional laborer. So now you got two guys using one jackhammer. and you go on and on and on until you, you know, until you can, until you've got 17 guys standing around and one guy still operating the jackhammer. That's kind of what the declining marginal productivity theory is describing, and it's not at all how firms actually structure themselves. So, you know, this declining marginal productivity, when you look at your average cost per unit curve as you go along the x-axis and your quantity goes up, sorry, I misspoke earlier. The average unit cost is the Nike swoosh that goes up over time because your marginal productivity is going down, so your average cost is going up. That is not at all. They've done studies on this where they've gone around to CFOs and COOs of major companies, and they've shown them different curves that you know that are supposed to approximate their average unit cost curve. And the way that about 90% of CFOs and COOs will answer is they'll pick one where the you know, where the unit cost goes down as you spread it over more units. These sort of basic economies of scale type of equation. You know, and engineers design factories to take into account this this sort of capacity utilization factor, so you're never running into a situation where you're trying to cram more units of labor into a fixed amount of capital and your actual productivity is going down. That's not how businesses in the real world work. You know, they will utilize themselves all the way up to 100% capacity. You know, for the most part, engineers build in a buffer so that by the time they've used up that buffer, they can already have expanded productive capacity. So you're never really running into that situation where your marginal productivity is going down over time. And so that kind of destroys the foundations upon which this assumption of declining marginal productivity are built.
Well, I'm going to disagree with you. I'm not going to say that's necessarily an Austrian kind of thing. I mean, if you go back to, you know, Henry Hazlitt, or, you know, if you could consider Bastiat kind of an early Austrian-ish thinker, of course, if you just kind of, the reason you would see declining marginal productivity is because that unit that you could put to that one productive capacity could go to another different place. And it's kind of up to the individual where he values the product or his ends in on his value scale, what he can get the next unit of, because they're not only making one product, you know, they could do other things. You know, like you said, when in the real world, when businesses reach maximum capacity in their factory and, you know, and they have extra resources, they're not just going to throw the extra resources to create declining productivity. Either they save or they invest in something else. So I think exactly.
So because they,
I don't think that's necessarily a criticism of the
Austrian. Because they do that, their productivity, the bare minimum. So you know, you really don't see and you know, after the show, I can send you the studies. There's more than one of them. You know, big surveys of thousands of global manufacturing companies of all kinds of different companies in different industries, and you know, you routinely see this average unit cost curve that declines over time. And at the worst, it flattens out rather than continuing to go down. But it's very, very rare that your average cost rises as you get further down the unit curve. I mean, especially in, you know, in any manufacturing business, in any capital intensive business, you know, the fixed costs compared to the variable costs are so massive. You know, just think Volkswagen, think Ford, yeah. think Coca-Cola. You know, your fixed compared to your variable are orders of magnitude larger. And so, you know, spreading those fixed over more units. All I'll say about that is, you know, engineers, they scratch their head when economists try to explain to them why the average cost curve rises over time, because that's not how engineers design things. And fundamentally, the reason that assumption is in there is so that you can get the marginal cost intersecting with the marginal revenue, having that be the point of, you know, highest productivity. That's the reason why that assumption is built into that model. So, you know, in my opinion, it's more of an assumption for a purpose than an assumption, because that's really the best approximation of reality. Because if you were to go to, you know, any American firm today, and if you were to throw out every piece of economics dogma that you had ever heard, you would try to model the unit cost based on what a business actually looks like.
Right. I mean, two things here. One, I don't think that's necessarily a South an Austrian assumption, or Austrians would believe, because, you know,
it's a neoclassical assumption for sure. I don't know. I don't pretend to know Austrian school nearly as well as I know the neoclassical. So I know for sure that that's a foundational piece of all of their analysis, all the ISLM, all that stuff, the DGSE. You know, it all rests upon this theory of the firm that is, you know, shaky at absolute best.
Well, it's kind of because, you know, this coming from the Austrian perspective here, the neoclassical assumption that revenues are going to equal costs, that kind of goes into their price theory, where the.
Yeah, and that doesn't happen either. This marginal revenue equal to marginal cost is not also how a business operates. You know,
right.
it assumes that
you're taking all these costs and then putting a profit on top of it when you present the price to the consumer. When in reality, what an entrepreneur or a business does is they think they can sell a good or a service at a certain price, so they bid for these other the input goods.
Exactly, and they fiercely defend their margins. They're not going to take a haircut on their margins if they do not have to. I mean, have you ever heard of a CEO getting up in front of, you know, his shareholders and saying, "Well, we're going to sell our next X number of products at our cost"? So there is no margin. So, you know, that those last 50 people we hired, we don't really need them. We just we're making our last 10,000 units to sell at marginal cost because this is what the formula says.
Yeah, they're not just going to stick with the price if no one's going to buy. The pricing system works backwards than what most people are, you know, taught it works. You know, the Marxist would say that the worker gets paid a certain amount, and then the capitalist, after he pays the worker a certain amount, he sells for this amount and takes a profit. But in reality, it's not the cost of the inputs that go into the final price. It's the price, which is the starting point, what he thinks he can sell it for. And then that price is divvied up among what he thinks he can use to produce it. If he's wrong, he takes a loss. If he's right. But that's the Austrian assumption. And it would make sense why, you know, from the neoclassical assumption where in order to make marginal revenue equal marginal cost, they kind of have to come up with all these funky curves that justify the theory.
They're just solving for what they need in order to. So they're coming up with all these assumptions that allow them to solve for marginal cost equals marginal revenue.
Right.
And that, you know, that is not working in a business. You never hear the term marginal revenue. You never hear it.
Never.
It's because it's not a real business term. It's, you know, I mean, I've valued several hundred companies in different industries, and I've never heard the term marginal revenue once outside of an economics classroom.
Which is
just a short tangent. Marxists, my favorite thing about Marxists is how terrible they are at accounting.
Yes.
Marxists do not understand accounting, because you ask them, so what happens to all those profits? And they say, well, the CEOs are paying themselves a big old bonus. No. CEO's salary and their bonus and everything else, that's already been netted out of profits. All, you know, they don't understand the idea of starting at revenue, going down, taking out COGS, taking out SG&A, taking out taxes, and getting all the way down to net income, which has already accounted for everybody's salary, everybody's bonus, everybody's health care.
But you don't understand. When it comes to all these greedy businessmen, they just take all the profits and they just exploit all the workers, and they take all the money, and they forget that you have to pay for the land, you have to pay all the stuff for the capital, all that. You got to do all that stuff before the entrepreneur actually gets paid. So I don't know what this whole Marxist exploiting the worker crap comes from.
And they don't know that that the CEO and the shareholders are not always the same person, especially for big public companies. Like, if you want to rail against ExxonMobil, guess what? The CEO of ExxonMobil is a shareholder in ExxonMobil, but he has a boss. You know, he has a board of directors, you know, that are made up of all the shareholders who own his company. He doesn't get to just keep ExxonMobil's profits. Like, yeah, he's going to get equity compensation packages that in effect give him, you know, splits of the profits and everything. But that's the shareholders choosing to hand that over to the CEO. And you know, and in that situation, the CEO is the worker and they're the management. So, like, you know, this – there's just this weird, it's because the word profit just makes them, it immediately makes them think that somebody has stolen something from someone. That's how they, that's how they always act, because they start talking about, well, do you really need this, that, and the other? You know, I was listening to a guy talk about, well, why can't the textile companies, like, why do they need to be making millions of dollars? Why can't they just pay these people in, you know, in Thailand and in Singapore and – or not Singapore, but Thailand and Bangladesh? And why can't they just pay them $10 an hour? Like, they could afford to take a hit. They're making, you know, they're making millions of dollars, and it's –
that's such a disingenuous argument from them, though. Like, they're the same people that'll say something, you know, we need welfare programs, or you're an evil, greedy person. And then you can make the same argument to them and say, well, why do these people need nutritious meals? Why can't they just eat dollar ramen noodles? You know, someone.
Well, exactly. Like, when you go up to that guy and you say, well, I'm going to take your cell phone and I'm going to redistribute it to the Bangladesh people. He's like, fuck you. That's my phone.
Yeah.
You know, that's mine. But do you really need that phone? Like, it's such a ridiculous argument, because it's not up to anybody else to decide what I need or what you need or what. If you decide that you want something and you have the ability to pay for it, and you're not committing force, you know, you're not initiating force against anybody, you're not stealing any money from them, guess what? You have every right to go do that thing, whatever it is. If you want to light stacks of $100 bills on fire to heat your house, go for it.
There's I always reference this, and I think I mentioned in the price controls episode, and I just want to read this paragraph real quick, because I reference it and wanted to make sure people had some Henry Hazlitt in their life. And I just this paragraph he has in Economics in One Lesson, a very good read. It's only like 100 and some pages, but but there's this paragraph he has where it just says profits actually do not bulk large in our total economy. The net income of incorporated business is in the 15 years from 1929 to 1943, and he goes on, but he says something really awesome. It is significant that while there is a word profiteer to stigmatize those who make allegedly excessive profits, there is no such word as wageer or lossier. Yet the profits of the owner of a barber shop may average much less, not merely, than the salary of a motion picture star or the hired head of a steel corporation, but less even than the average wage for a skilled labor. So it's just like they've made some sort of word always to stigmatize somebody who makes profits, but you never hear anything, you know, there's not a lossier or wageer. And so it's just like they've made a language to make sure that, you know, they stigmatize people who make money. But that's the point. You know, everybody is out to make money. That's what we do to survive. So, you know, it's just like they just want to stigmatize people who are just doing what we do in the first place, which is to make money so that, you know, you can provide for your family, provide just to live, because that's what we have to do in an economy.
Well, yeah.
The basic
kind of weakness. Oh, sorry.
So I just wanted to throw one last point out. So also the biggest probably like unspoken logical flaw in that sort of Marxist thinking is, and I said this to the guy, I said, okay, you go ahead and you run your textile business at break even every year. And then 5 years afterwards, when you have your first losing year ever, you are out of business. Your textile mill no longer exists. Because during those times when you're running it at break even, you have absolutely no cushion against a down year where you might lose some money. And so, you know, by deciding not to make profits, by paying everybody, you know, this big old living wage, and this actually happened. I don't know if you guys saw it, that company was in Washington, I think, that decided they're going to pay everyone $70K a year. They went under. So now no one has any jobs.
Yeah. No, it was the guy with the long hair. You know who I'm talking about? The CEO with the long hair who went on the news stations and he told everyone how he was so cool because he was paying all of his employees a $70,000 wage.
Oh, I can't remember.
Supposedly, you know, I read afterwards it was kind of a political move against his partner so that his company would like him more and not the other guy, but. Anyway,
it's also hoping that he was going to benefit tremendously from this publicity stunt.
Yeah.
And what happened was he didn't get more customers, but he got a whole lot more job applications.
That's true. So to bring it back around to our first point, kind of about the marginal cost curve, which how many tangents must we have gone on that?
But you know, we can talk about this for that's how my brain works.
It's just how libertarians work, guys. Just get used to it. But I think that, you know, when you said, you know, that might be somewhere the Austrians kind of have an assumption wrong. I'm just going to say, I don't think that's an Austrian assumption.
I know that in many areas, the Austrian school and the neoclassical overlap. You know, like I said, I don't pretend to know all of the areas where they do and don't, because there are some very specific ones where the Austrians differ, and then there are some areas where where the economics is much older that both Austrians and neoclassicals kind of both lean on that.
Well, here's where it kind of comes from: is that they seem to reach the same conclusions by taking they reach the same destination with different roads in a lot of things. And, you know, a lot of people on the left, one of the reasons why Austrian economics has never really been mentioned is because it's just one of those free market things. And I guess for them, all free market is kind of lumped in together where let me give you an example. When the Keynesian school really started to be taking off and the socialists started gaining a lot of headway, you know, through the progressive movement and whatnot, Mises and Hayek put on a seminar in was it in Switzerland or something? It was like a week long, and they brought all kinds of, you know, free market leaning economists, and they're, you know, Milton Friedman and his people went, and there was another school that kind of went that was really a very odd.
Yeah, option. I know what you're talking about. They talked about that that week thing in Keynes Hayek.
Yes, that documentary. That good documentary, by the way. I think you can find it on YouTube. But one of the things that got to me, and one of the, you know, this is the really the place where Austrians and Chicago school people kind of have the most contention is that Austrians will always apply their logic, you know, kind of they start with the true axioms and logically deduce their positions from those axioms. Whereas, you know, when it comes to a Chicago school person, you know how we talked with the marginal revenue, marginal cost curve and having to figure something else out and kind of pull it out of a hat to justify their position on one thing. You know, it kind of the way that kind of economics is run is you start with your conclusion and you try to find how to work the statistics to match your bias. So, and, you know, Milton Friedman even said at one time they were debating this or talking about basic minimum income or something. And I mean, everyone's got to remember this is a bunch of, you know, free market people, you know, guys that would never be invited on MSNBC or the guys that are always demonized in sociology departments. So they're all the same to the leftists. But to all these libertarians and
economists. Well, no, towards the very end of his life, Milton Friedman was very, very establishment, very he wouldn't get on MSNBC, but they'd certainly have Milton Friedman on, you know, Meet the Press or any of those sort of centrist media platforms. Because,
yeah.
You know, he while he maintained sort of the free market veneer, he certainly was, you know, intimately involved in the right wing monetary Federal Reserve establishment.
So, yeah. And like during this meeting, this is a bunch of libertarians and economists and quote unquote free market people. You got to realize this. Some of the leading free market thinkers in the world. And they were having a debate or something, and Ludwig von Mises stood up and he slammed his fist on the table and he said, "You're all a bunch of socialists," and walked out of the room because of the positions that some of the, you know, probably some of the Chicago school people were trying to justify, you know, why we need a central bank and why this policy prescription has to come, and trying to pull out a bunch of numbers out of the hat to, because they fiddled with the regression or the model to, you know, justify their position. And what you said about Friedman's really interesting. Because I've read some things that said, you know, maybe Friedman publicly was like that, you know, just willing to compromise because he recognized the reality of the situation in most points. But his son, David, is, you know, he's not an Austrian, but he is an anarcho-capitalist, not in the Rothbardian mold. But, you know, he still said he would. And, you know, he even says his dad would, you know, agree with him on most things and just say, well, that's just not the reality of what people are going to go for. So, you know, the some of the personalities in the history of it's fascinating.
So one of the things that I wanted to bring up that's kind of lumped into the topic that I picked out for today is the topic of sort of the banking system and how that relates to what we are probably on the precipice of. You know, we certainly had it happen in 2007, which is a deleveraging. And so if I can just, you know, kind of outline for those listening. So basically what you have in the economy is you have a short-term debt cycle and you have a long-term debt cycle. The short-term debt cycle would be like your 1982 recession to your, you know, to your recovery all the way to 1987. So between 82 and 87, you have a period which is bookended by two recessions, with an expansion in the middle, and that's the short term debt cycle, and that's mostly controlled by sort of the Federal Reserve fiddling with the interest rates, sort of over expansion of credit, and then you know, trying to tighten it down, and that causes what we sometimes refer to as business cycle recessions. Business cycle recessions are not fun by any means, but they can be dealt with by, you know, sufficiently dropping interest rates, providing liquidity to the economy, and essentially waiting for the borrowing and the capital investment to kick up a notch. The difference between that and what we had during the beginning of the Great Depression and in 2007 to 2008 is we had peaks and then beginnings of troughs in the long-term debt cycle. You know, so I will send you guys some diagrams and everything that you can link to in some kind of notes for this or anything. But if you look at a diagram of the total debt to GDP ratio in the United States, and total debt includes both government debt and private debt. It's one of sort of the great secrets that you hear the politicians talk about government debt all the time, but private debt dwarfs government debt by like a factor of 4 to 1. It's you know, it's quite different in terms of the size of the market. So that private debt includes everything from credit card loans, student loans, mortgages, personal loans, just about everything. And if you look, so what we have in the United States is we have a pure fiat money system, a credit money system, where our existing money supply is not backed by anything. It is literally lent into existence. So, you know, in your guys' previous episode, I heard, you know, sort of what I call the de facto description of how a bank works, which is not in reality how a bank works. So the sort of lesson that they teach you about how fractional reserve banking works is that I go into a branch of my local bank and I take my $100 that I've got in my pocket and I open up a savings account. You know, and I put that money in the bank and then I leave, and the bank will then lend that money out, you know, and because it's fractional reserve, it can lend $10 for every $1 that it has, et cetera, et cetera. And so you get the, you know, the money multiplier based on that. That's not at all actually how banks work in reality. There is no need for deposits in a bank. And the reason there is no need for deposits is because loans create deposits. So if you walk into Bank of America and you apply for a mortgage, Bank of America, when they decide to grant you that mortgage, will then credit your account for, say, $100,000. So they've got a $100,000 liability on their books that's now sitting in your account, but they just write up a $100,000 asset, the loan, on the other side of it. There is no need for anybody's deposit money or anything like that. You might ask, well, what about the reserves? They got to have the reserves, right? Well, yes, in theory, they do have to have the reserves, but the reserves in no way constrain their lending. And the reason that reserves don't constrain the lending is because A, they can borrow reserves on the overnight market, or B, they can borrow reserves from the Federal Reserve. So that they're really, you know, if they're in the red on their reserves, it doesn't matter. The Federal Reserve is not going to shut down Bank of America. And so what you have there, is you have, you know, what certain economists will refer to as a endogenous money system, basically meaning that a lot of people sort of describe, the U.S. monetary system as almost like a push system from the Fed down. And it's really not. It's really a demand pull system, whereby the banks that make up the Federal Reserve, so Citi, Wells Fargo, Bank of America, Chase, they are responsible for about 95% of the monetary creation. Really, the only part of the money supply that's under the direct control of the Federal Reserve is the M0. If you compare the size of the M0 to the M3, it's enormous. You know, very, very little, very, very few transactions these days occur in cash.
So here's the deal. I had to jump in somewhere.
Yeah, no worries.
I wanted to get on to where you were talking about the fractional reserve banking and how, you know, basically the reserve doesn't really matter because they can just, you know, write the asset, write the credit for it, and then you have the credit that they wrote for you even if the money's not there, so it doesn't necessarily constrain on the fractional reserve. But,
well, no, the money becomes there because they just put it in your account.
Right. So that's the whole point. Basically, from a free banking standpoint, now when Austrians talk about free banking, they talk about when the bank has money, when the bank acts as a warehouse for the money and lends it out, the bank literally transfers ownership of the money to the borrowing party, and they cannot lend what they do not have.
Yeah, and basically that just means they can't create brand new money.
And they when libertarians talk about sound money or Austrians talk about sound money or free banking, mm-hmm. you can't create money on top of that because that's basically fraud.
Yeah,
is what it would be. So now how the reserves kind of fractional reserves kind of play into this. Now think about it from what you said when the bank writes the $100,000 loan and puts the money in your account. It does. You're right. It does create another deposit, but when that deposit hits another bank. In a fractional reserve system, or maybe it hits the same bank, all of a sudden on their books, they also show the deposit of $100,000, and then they can exponentially lend on top of that $100,000 that they already created.
Well, but when it moves from my bank, so when it moves from Bank of America over to Chase, that fundamentally doesn't matter because it's not moving outside of the banking system. So within right. each bank, you have, your assets, your liabilities, and your equity. You've got your sort of accounting, double entry bookkeeping. But that also holds true for the banking system as a whole.
Exactly.
It never happens that somebody says, okay, I want a $100,000 mortgage. I'm going to take that all in cash. Like nobody does that. Because nobody's going to bring – we're not in Colombia. We don't bring suitcases full of cash to close, on houses. So
why wouldn't they do that, though? Why don't they?
So here's where –
the cops would probably take it. So that's why.
Coming from?
They'd say you're
– if you would read, Rothbard's What Has Government Done to Our Money, basically a free banking system, how it comes about, the banks basically acts as warehouse where they would store your money. And what the money is, it would basically be linked to something sound where it could be gold, silver, table chairs, remote controls, who knows, whatever the society decides what money is or what their unit of exchange, medium of exchange is, just say it's gold. What happens in free banking is you put the gold in that warehouse and, it's kind of burdensome to carry all that around. If you wanted a check or a cashier's check or something, the warehouse, the bank would then issue a receipt to you. So it would look like a check for $100,000, but they're not going to give you banknotes in, $100 bills and paper to carry around in a couple suitcases. Basically, from the Austrian perspective, a free banking system based on sound money and 100% reserve banking would end up being, the paper notes are basically just conveniences to carry around, so you don't have to actually carry the unit of measure around with you. Now, what would happen is when you get that loan, you get the $100,000 check or cashier's check. Your Bank of America ran this when you did take it to Chase. Basically, what Chase would do, Chase would put a call in on the reserves from the first bank, and the first bank would then transfer the money to Chase, so then Chase could loan out that way. Now you could.
Yeah, and
foreseeably enter into contracts where you there's a certain amount of time you can't touch your money because it's being lent out in order to earn a little bit of interest on it.
Like and a certain deposit.
Can be inflationary, but they can't lend in a free banking system, based on some kind of sound money where the paper money is basically bank receipts. You can't expand on money that's already been expanded because
in 100% reserve banking system, you can only grow because your money supply doesn't grow, or because they elect only to grow the money supply at the rate of productivity growth or whatever. You can't consume more than is earned in any given year,
exactly.
Which is the difference. It's the difference between what we have now and what you're talking about. Because what we have now, any of us in 1 year can consume, assuming we have a zero balance on our assets and debt, we can consume in any given year our entire income plus the net borrowing from the banking sector.
Exactly.
So if I went out and borrowed $25,000 this year and I earned $50,000, I can consume $75,000 worth of stuff. That $25,000 that I borrowed from the banking system has been added to the money supply. There is no requirement. There's no practical requirement that, the difference between what we have now, what you're talking about is in the Austrian, 100% reserve banking system. If I borrow $25,000, it's because you did not spend $25,000 of your income. And so you have set it aside and you are lending it to me. It's one non-bank agent lending to another non-bank agent. Whereas in our current economy, all non-bank agents borrow from the banking system. When you get a loan, obviously you can borrow from relatives and you can borrow, and that does nothing to the money supply. The crazy thing about it is, guys like Paul Krugman and guys like Ben Bernanke, when they're modeling the U.S. macro economy, they treat the banking sector like it's the Austrian 100% reserve banking system, where people that are borrowing are less patient agents borrowing from more patient agents, and that's not how the system works at all.
And that is the fundamental flaw in the whole thing, where Austrians say this is what kicks off the business cycle. One, when you lower interest rates, and you don't have, and the reason you can artificially lower interest rates is because the bank's on fiat, where it's not based on sound money, it's not based on savings, and it's not based on the time preferences of what you said, alluded to before, patient lenders or patient savers who want more in the future than they do today, because productivity has become so high that it's allowed them to save a little bit more money so that they can invest for something in the future. And also piggybacking on what you said, basically if you have $50,000 and borrow $25,000, you can consume $75,000 worth of things. What it leads to is implicit capital consumption that you don't necessarily see in a full 100% reserve system, because it's able to inflate and it's able to create the new funds. And like you said, Krugman and Bernanke, they treat the new funds as if it were saved money when it's just printed money. So what it ends up doing is it ends up misallocating resources in all kinds of different sectors of the economy, which bid up prices and producers' goods industries. And what ends up happening there is it outbids products from, say, where consumers would normally want it. And then you have an overproduction of one thing that people don't necessarily want, an underproduction of another thing that people or the market would want. And in the middle of that, you have capital consumption. You basically have people eating their seed crop.
Yeah, well, and you have another couple of very unfortunate and dangerous things happening along the way. So when you're looking at let's take a little tour back through American history. So as the United States emerges from the Second World War, if we're looking at a chart of the U.S. debt to GDP ratio, what the war has essentially done is, when people say it brought us out of the Great Depression, it's a yes and a no. Like, it did and it didn't. What it really did is it got people to accept much, much, much lower standards of living during a extended period of time. So therefore, what they were doing is repairing their balance sheets that were so badly over leveraged during the 1930s. You'll see this also going on in Japan right now. What a lot of economic Manchurians like to do is they like to take the deleveraging and they try to spread it out over a very long period of time. And so you get sort of this general morose in the economy because it's not growing, but it's not shrinking either. It's just kind of chugging along and
trying to pull the Band-Aid off.
And the hope is that what what their hope is that they can keep the nominal growth rate above the nominal interest rate, create enough inflation, and kind of just gently peel away the massive amount of leverage that's sitting in the system. But so, okay, so we've gone through the war. America's repaired its balance sheets. We're now ready to get fucking going, you know, because we've been in this depression, but man, do we get going, you know, and we've got people buying homes, they're getting mortgages, everybody's getting cars, you know, the economy starts humming, and that borrowing starts kicking up, and at the very beginning, that's a good thing, because that borrowing is going to finance productive investment. We're building manufacturing plants, we're rebuilding Europe with the Marshall Plan, we're doing shit with it. We're taking our capital and we're building things that make things so that we have more capital in the future. But as we start to, you know, as we start to get towards the 60s and the 70s, you know, our productivity, you know, per dollar, our productivity gains are starting to slow down, and we're starting to spend a lot of our money on some really dumb shit. You know, and we're fundamentally, you know, devaluing the dollar. We're pushing towards the end of the Bretton Woods system. And so, you know, then you hit the stagflation of the 70s, and the real problem, and this whole time, mind you, you might have tiny little dips in the leverage amounts of the debt to GDP ratio, but the long-term trend is up, 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 and the long-term trend is up in a more steep direction, meaning the year-over-year increase in debt to GDP is getting bigger each and every year. And in the 1980s, like, it's not that this wasn't happening in the 60s and 70s, but in the 1980s, what starts to happen is you get the financialization of the economy. So the financial sector, the banking sector, is now becoming a much larger portion of the economy than it was before. You know, and fundamentally, the banking sector exists to move money to productive enterprises, and that's it. That's it. But the banking sector really likes to create new fun jobs for itself, like asset management, like, you know, like creating new derivative products, like doing this, that, and the other thing. And they start to use some of that added leverage to purchase financial assets. Now, when you're leveraging up and you're buying assets into a rising market, that's called a Ponzi scheme, and it's fundamentally unsustainable, but at the very beginning of any Ponzi scheme, things look like they're going fantastically. And all the people that got in real early, they're making money hand over fist. But the only thing that keeps the Ponzi scheme running is more debt. Because you're not actually adding productive capacity and the money value's inflating away, you gotta pile ever more debt onto the puzzle. And so this, you know, this continues to go on. It dips a little bit in 2001, but by the time we get to 2007, the second derivative of the debt to GDP graph of the United States of America is like 14% a year, meaning the debt to GDP ratio of the U.S. is growing at a rate of 14% a year. It's almost the second derivative has almost gone vertical. And what happens when you know, and we're looking at, you know, an economy with like over 200% debt to GDP ratio, meaning that the economy itself is very, very, very fragile. Because everybody's super levered up. You know, one of my finance professors in college said, leverage is a lot like cocaine. It makes the good times better and the bad times worse.
Yeah. I'm going to have to interrupt for a second because I have no clue where we're at in our schedule of show, and we're like over an hour in.
Well, we talked for about an hour beforehand, I think.
So
I can kind of wrap this up if you need me to.
Yeah, and then I want to hit on a couple points too.
Sure. Okay. So you get to 2007, and in 2007 is the first time that the second derivative actually goes negative, meaning the change in the direction of the debt to GDP. We don't actually decrease the debt to GDP ratio. We just slow down the rate, and that in and of itself was enough to tip the global economy into a crisis. The crisis from which we have not yet recovered because we did not allow the crisis to really become a crisis. We did not deleverage effectively. You know, we got the very beginnings of a deflationary deleveraging, but ever since then, it's been kind of full steam ahead. Try to reinflate the bubble, and what it's done is you've seen Janet Yellen at Alia in the United States doing everything that they can to try to get 3 to 4% CPI inflation. They're not able to get it, but you're getting massive amounts of financial asset price inflation, and they helped blow the world's largest fixed asset bubble in China.
Yeah, I mean, those are – I'm going to kind of take it from a more meta, I guess you could say, theoretical approach. You pointed out also what happens when, you know, borrowing a lot of times in an economy, it signals new projects. Whether you're an entrepreneur and you're borrowing to expand your business, or you're a consumer and you're borrowing to, you know – maybe get a new car or a washing machine or something that you didn't have previously. Now, where Austrians would say, you know, this can be a good thing is if there is capital already that exists in the bank from real people saving actual capital in order to fund these kinds of projects. But you also, and you pointed that out, you said, you know, people were trying to reestablish their checkbooks and their balances and this and that. But you also hit on the point what happens where leverage really starts to undo you is when it becomes the Ponzi scheme and when it starts piling on top of each other and this and that and just having to pump more money out so people start taking on new projects so that prices go up and we can look at the numbers and we can look at our graphs and say, oh, look, see how well the economy is humming along. Because that's normally what happens is whenever the bubble pops, all of the so-called experts, they never see it coming. But they always take credit for it when times are riding high. So yeah. I guess Austrians, you know, we're not necessarily against borrowing and investing in this and that. What an Austrian would come from is it needs to come from real saved capital so you know what you can really afford so that it doesn't set you back. And you have to figure out every 10, 20 years what to do with your money because the capital structure becomes so depleted because it's basically inflation and leverage. And you're right, you know, it is like cocaine. The times are good when it's high, but that's because someone can just create more and more and more of it. And these people that are dealing in these markets, they think they're making all this profit and money, but it's really just inflation. You know what I'm saying?
Yeah. Well, and the thing about leverage that's another reason it's like cocaine is it's very tempting because if you made an investment in Apple stock. You know, and you bought it at $400 and it went up $100 and you sold it at $500. You know, you just made yourself a good investment. But then you start thinking, man, if I had bought that stock on margin, I would have made a shitload of money. And you start to the financial system itself, what happens right after we have the financial crisis, only the safest, most reputable projects are getting financed. Only Apple and Google and Coca-Cola have access to the credit markets. You know, and their safe projects, they do well. And then as time goes on, because those projects do well, And, you know, so the banking system is now willing to finance medium risk projects, you know, and it's always looking back at sort of the last cycle of what they just financed and thinking, man, we could have gone a little bit more leverage on that because it worked out. We could have, you know, we could have pushed another turn of EBITDA leverage onto that business when we recapped it. Because look, it's, you know, they achieved their 20% sales growth that we were worried they might not get. And so there's always that, you know, the generals are sort of always fighting the last war. And you see this all the time, like in the sort of, in the financial models that, that everyone uses on Wall Street, they're all using correlations and everything from the period that just passed, which I've heard described is like driving by looking in the rearview mirror. It's and one more thing I just want to add on what you were saying about the, you know, about the saving and everything. One of the things that, you know, that it's been tough for Bernanke and Janet Yellen and all of the economic mandarins of the United States to find out is that you can drop the Fed funds rate to 0% and you can do QE until the cows come home, and you cannot make over indebted people go out and borrow more money. You just can't. Like the American consumer right now, the average American citizen is in no position to take on new borrowing. They're struggling just to continue to roll over their current debt balances. And so that's really why you haven't seen all this new bank lending since the financial crisis. It's because there's nobody for them to lend to.
Well, banks can always lend to banks. Like what you, they can keep piling up on top of the Ponzi scheme and leverage.
Oh yeah, yeah, yeah. But that's never going to get the consumer spending number. That's never going to bring the real economy roaring back. Well, that's going to just.
I mean, I was going to say the reason is, you know, banks get their money from the pot at the end of the rainbow. They get it from the discount rate, and they get it from a central entity, a central bank that's always willing to rev up the economy and rev up spending in any which way or form. But it's different for an everyday consumer who doesn't have that pot at the end of the rainbow. And basically their consumption or their amount of leverage is limited by what they actually have. And but what's scary is what they actually have, it, the value of it or the price of it is based on the leverage of everyone else in the system. And then if that
– yeah. And it,
yeah. So
find out in 2007 that, you know, I'm a responsible guy that's never missed a mortgage payment. And, you know, I've got this nice IRA that I've been saving for 25. Holy shit, everything's worth 30% less.
Yep.
And it had nothing to do with those people. And that's the scariest part about where we are right now. You know, I don't know how closely you guys sort of watch the financial markets. That's just something that that I do, you know, as a hobby on top of my other job. But man, the way that the system is set up right now, it's so incredibly fragile. It's so interconnected, and there's so many, you know, there's so many liquidity black holes, like AIG was in the last financial crisis. You know, all the institutions that were too big to fail are now bigger. The, you know, the systemic problems that were there in the global economy, the biggest one being the over leverage, has gotten worse. You know, China started the last crisis, you know, at, I can't remember, maybe 75% debt to GDP. And they've ramped it up to like 275. They're now more indebted on a debt to GDP ratio than we in America are.
Well, you know what?
They're the second biggest economy in the world.
Up until last year, I was actually a licensed home mortgage loan originator, believe it or not. At my place of business, you know, me and my branch manager, we share the same office. So we would, you know, watch the bond market, watch the interest rates. Nobody knew what the Fed was going to do ever. Nobody, you know, in a normal, this is scary. No one knows how to forecast. No one knows whether to float or lock their borrowers because nobody knows where things are going. They just kind of have to shut their eyes, play roulette, and hope for the best. And that's what's really scary. That's what led me to look more into, you know, economics and banking and business cycles and this and that. I mean, that's absolutely terrifying.
I think what's even more, what's even scarier than an unpredictable Fed, is what happens when the Fed loses control.
What do you mean lose, when they lose control?
When the market acknowledges that the Fed has lost control.
All right.
Because basically what they're going to do, you know, they're leaning as hard as they can on the yield curve right now. And they can pretty much buckle the front of the yield curve, but not the back of the yield curve. They really don't have that much say over the 30-year yield and the 20-year yield. The guys at Bridgewater put out a report a couple of years ago now, because everything in fucking Fedland takes like 2 years longer than you think it will. Who thought we were going to have 7 years of zero interest rates? But they were saying what we predict is that the Fed is going to try to hit the gas pedal as hard as they've been hitting it, in the recent years. What we're worried about is that there's not very much gas left in the tank. That's what the guys at Bridgewater said. And I said, oh, shit, if they're worried about this, I better be worried about this. Because those guys are, you know, they're the biggest macro hedge fund in the world for a reason.
Right. One last thing here. The Austrian would kind of say that the Fed shouldn't even have gas in the tank, and that's what sets the whole thing off.
Amen. Hallelujah. Yeah. Thank you.
For sure. Fuck the central bank.
So, I thought this was really, really productive, Chad. Obviously, super knowledgeable. I learned some things, that some statistics, some data that I hadn't previously been able to recall. We want to have you back on at some point.
Yes,
for sure.
Amen.
Sure, man. I'll do it whenever. I'm hoping to start a podcast of my own. Kim's trying to help me salvage some audio from a thing. So, you know, I'm doing some writing and whatnot on the criminal justice system right now. But, you know, I have every intention of sort of my podcast being very much a variety type of thing. I mean, it's just going to be sort of the same thing as my writing, which is just whatever I'm interested in at the time. So, I'll definitely come back on,
You're making a random podcast just with random stuff? Is that what that is?
It's called the International Man of Mystery Hour.
It's
very mysterious.
You better just give me RSS feed for that, man. I'll listen to it.
Yeah, so, but yeah, I had a lot of fun, and I'll shoot Kim over some of that material that I was referencing, because I think, I don't know if you, do you guys do like a show notes page or whatever? I fucking hate when people say show notes, whenever you're talking about like academic stuff or economic stuff, especially, when I'm trying to visually talk out a chart, it's just nice to link to the chart or like, if you do like a YouTube version of the conversation, put the chart up on the video, that kind of stuff. Just ideas to kick around.
Well, so far we haven't had much of a reason to, because we didn't have many charts for this is probably mm-hmm. other than I think our price controls episode is like, I think the farthest we went into economics in detail.
In the technical aspect of it.
Yeah, so probably when we do episodes like this, we can probably do show notes, as it's called, where we can put the links in there.
Links.
Yeah, or
yeah,
links.
The links are links.
Yeah, but you might want to shoot those over to me real quick, because I'm probably going to have to put them in here and get them out on the feed pretty quickly.
I shot you a copy of that Bridgewater packet it's just a bunch of Bridgewater stuff on macroeconomics. It's for my money, some of the best stuff in the business. Like they write amazing research, and are very much worth reading. I don't know what their economic school is, but you know, if you just look at sort of free market results, they're the biggest macro asset manager in the world, and so something they're doing works.
Right on.
So are we ready to wrap up then?
Yes. Alrighty. Well, in that case, I guess that's my job. I was just having more fun listening to you two go at it. You know, I just moderate.
I record an outro.
Huh? We agreed on like everything. We didn't go at it. We were like holding hands and licking the same ice cream cone.
Well, yeah. Well, I think in this episode was probably.
I'll take the Marxist position next time and just argue that profits are the creation of Satan.
Now, if we have you on a podcast with the rest of the round table, you won't have to be the one to take that position.
Yeah, trust me, that won't be a problem then. Yeah, we'll have some dissent in that situation. So, yeah, don't worry about that. But this one, I think,
agents from Couture Marxists.
Now, I think this one was more informative, so I think people probably like, you know, having some information this time around as opposed to listening to us argue at each other all the time. But anyway, in that case, for everybody, if you want to get in contact with us, you can email us at newbornlibertarian@gmail.com. Hit us up on Twitter at Newborn Liberty. Search out the Facebook group at Newborn Libertarian. Search that out. And definitely, if you can hit us up on iTunes and maybe leave us some ratings and comments, because we got nothing there. And I'm not just saying that so we can seem cool and have some comments there. It's just so you can give us some constructive criticism, say good things, say bad things. Whether you say good things or bad things, just give us some comments where we can improve or the things you like, whatever. We need all the whatever we can get. And also so that more people will be able to find the show so we can have more of you cool people on the show if you have things to say. And we like people from all political backgrounds, all economic theories, everybody who just wants to talk about stuff. We love having you on. And once again, this has been Kim with my wonderful co-hosts, which are
Christian.
And he's
there. Chad there.
Yeah, there he is. Chad, who also likes MMA. So, but we won't get into MMA on this podcast. Maybe if I get a chance to get on his podcast,
that's,
we'll talk about
subject for my podcast. Oh, yeah. Well, that'll be just.
But anyway, thank you guys for joining us this week once again. And you guys go out and enjoy some liberty and maybe study some economics in these links that we're going to give you in this week's podcast. Until next time, bye.